May it please the court. This case involves a different issue from those presented in the previous two cases, insofar as in this case the state did raise the defense of untimeliness and then intentionally withdrew its objection. The record is clear on that. The state filed a motion to dismiss, and as appellant was prepared to litigate his motion, apparently with witnesses, the state did withdraw it, and that's in the legal file. Such a withdrawal operates on two planes, both as a waiver of that issue itself, for all objections and defenses are waived if they are raised and abandoned, and further, the state is, itself is precluded from arguing untimeliness in this court by the doctrine of judicial estoppel. That doctrine operates to foreclose a party from taking an entirely different position on appeal than that taken in the lower court when the other side relied upon that earlier position to its disadvantage. The parties are continuous in this case, and one party is bound, or the state here is bound by the state's actions in the motion court. If the state had legitimate concerns about the timeliness of appellant's motion, it was its duty to follow through with its motion to dismiss.
Does the court have an independent right to enforce its own rules on timeliness, even if not raised by opposing counsel?
That's part I would like to address, and maybe I'll just jump right to that, because respondent does rely in this case on Swofford versus State, a case that holds that rules can't be circumvented by the actions of parties because the rules are for the court's benefit. This case was analyzed in Snyder versus State, in which the court engaged in some reasoning that was very straightforward. And that reasoning is to look at the rule, and I think that hasn't been discussed today, that Rule 24035 and Rule 2915B speak of waiver. The failure to file a motion timely is a waiver. It is a complete waiver, and it is a complete waiver of all claims that could have been raised in that motion, as well as claims that were raised in that motion. But be it never so complete and be it never so extensive, the word is waiver. The word is not authority. And we will search in vain for the term authority in that case.
And I think the question is
what's the difference, really, just so I understand? I mean, if the rule that allows for your relief twice says shall and says it shall be waived if you don't file it within the rule that says it shall be filed in 90 days, why should the parties have any control over that? I mean, why shouldn't the motion court be able to listen to all the evidence presented by both parties and rule in accordance with the law, which includes these two rules?
And the state keeps raising that again and again, Your Honor. The problem is that's not the issue presented here. The question is, by the time we get to the appeal, is it waived? I would agree with
that. Well, no, the 29D isn't talking about waiver on appeal. It's talking about waiver in the motion court.
Right. And that is, I'm sorry.
So whether anybody files a motion to dismiss or any sort of responsive pleading, why doesn't the motion court have an obligation, as it does in all cases, to base its decision upon the pleadings and the evidence presented to it in accordance with the law? And if the law says it shall be filed in 90 days, and if it isn't filed, it shall be waived, why doesn't the motion court have an obligation on its own to dismiss a claim that doesn't fall within the rules that allow for the relief?
Because the rules don't require that of the court. The rules, and this is what Snyder pointed to, 5508 provides that waiver is actually an affirmative defense or avoidance. It is a defense that must be pleaded if a responsive pleading is required. The courts that have analyzed Snyder since that, I think because Snyder Snyder camped on that.
A responsive pleading isn't required.
Correct, Your Honor. 55, then that moves us to 5509, which refers to situations where a responsive pleading is not required, and these are all in the appendix of my brief. 5509 provides that if a responsive pleading is not required, all allegations deemed in the pleading petition are taken as denied. It doesn't make any statement as to affirmative defenses.
But it doesn't require an affirmative defense
to
be
not,
pled,
Your Honor.
Does it?
It does not.
I mean, an affirmative defense only has to be pled if you have a pleading that
I absolutely
is required
agree.
To be filed.
I absolutely agree. Snyder also cites to Rule 5527, which I also did in my brief, and that provides that if there is no responsive pleading required, the affirmative defense, the avoidance, which waiver is, may be raised at the hearing. Now, that may not be very efficient and not a good use of judicial resources, but under the rules, the state could have raised this as late as the hearing.
You're making it that there's a distinction between what must be pled and what must be raised at the trial proceeding.
I'm arguing if the state had raised it at the hearing in this case for the first time.
Yeah, what I'm saying is just because they didn't have to raise it in their pleading does not mean they might not have had to raise it at the hearing.
That's correct. Yeah. I'm saying that they didn't have to file an answer because all their allegations in the motion are deemed by 5509 to have been denied.
Doesn't this in some sense fall on whether we look at this as a defense or a requirement of the claim?
Yes, Your Honor, it absolutely
does. And if this
does.
Is a requirement of the claim, why can't it be raised at any time, anywhere, that this element simply has not been proved? I mean, you know, the words complete waiver are pretty unique. I don't think we use those words very often.
They are. I agree. And it is a complete waiver, but it is waiver. And waiver is a term that, and 5508 was in existence at the time, 24035.
I mean, who knows?
It could be
complete
super
waiver.
Infinite,
that's
forever.
A different, that's it's a modification that must mean something.
That could be. But it is still the term waiver. And unless we want to equivocate about that, it is used in 5508 as an avoidance or an affirmative defense. They used the term waiver. They did not
really,
say the court lacks
you know, the
authority.
Truth is 5508 wasn't written with this in mind.
That may be, but it
I mean,
is the,
I mean,
there.
The, you know,
but
5508 and 5509 in reference to 2915, you know, that they're not always complete fits.
They are not, but that term was, I mean, that waiver was an affirmative defense
well,
at 20, the time, 24035.
Rule 29 and 24035, they specifically say, don't they, that the rules of civil procedure only as applicable? I mean, they don't necessarily incorporate, those rules don't necessarily incorporate all the civil rules, do they? I mean, in
they
fact,
don't.
We've got lots of cases that go through and say, well, that's not applicable. It doesn't apply to post-conviction.
That may be, but the language of 24035B does state waiver. And waiver
and
is
by, what does it mean by waiver? What doesn't it mean in that case, Barr, that in fact the consequences of not filing it means you have no claim and your claim is barred? Whether it uses waiver, whether it used another, the use of that term in that rule means you cannot proceed on your claim. It doesn't mean that it's the another party has some right that they've waived. It means that the court is saying you can't proceed if you have not filed a timely.
They sure didn't say that. I understand the court's position, and the court has said that this
is
authority.
Wasn't 2915B written in response to 2726, which allowed successive motions? And so the time bar was written with the idea that not only were you waiving claims that you brought in an untimely motion, but you were raising any claims that could be waived. Because the previous version of this rule allowed for successive motions if things came to your attention after the fact, even after the fact that you had already filed and lost one post-conviction motion. I mean,
it
that's
may
why
have been changed afterwards, but that is correct. It was amended to say not only the claims that
right.
are raised in
so,
this
so,
motion, but that can have been.
Right. So the time limit was raised not only to limit the time when claims can be filed, but also limit the fact that if you didn't raise it timely, you couldn't bring these claims ever.
That is correct. That is how it was. The rules, they do apply insofar as applicable, and the question, of course, is whether Rule 5508, 5509, and 5527 will apply here. Waiver has been taken and enforced again and again as more of an affirmative defense than as a prerequisite to the court's
and
authority.
The question is, what you're proposing is that waiver means waiver as it would in the context of 5508. And so if, in fact, that doesn't appear to be how it's used, we would look at the context of how the term waiver is used to see whether it means the same thing as it's used in 5508. And if we disagree with you, if we find that the post-conviction rules supersede or create a different procedure and 5508 doesn't require an affirmative defense, is there another argument under which you win, or is that the end of your analysis?
I would certainly contend that even if the court didn't apply 5508 in this way, which I certainly it would be appropriate, it's still a waiver for the reasons that have been stated before. It is a defense. It's an avoidance that should be, that does not go to the court's authority. It's, again, as the court has just stated, as Your Honor has just stated, it's a matter of how you interpret that statement, waiver. But it's the meaning of waiver, having been given the fact that these rules do provide that, and Rule 24035 and 2915B were enacted with those rules there, would indicate that that was the intent.
Can I ask the question in a different way? Rather than worry about the theoretical meaning of words, why shouldn't a claimant under 2915 be required to say, here's when my judgment occurred, or here was my trigger date, and here's when my filing is, and if it's without the time limits, if it's outside of the time limits, explain why. Why shouldn't that be the way the rule should work?
Well, these people file Form 40s that don't have that. But I think the reason that doesn't work on the Form 40 anyway is because, as has been stated before, the problems usually happen afterwards, and they probably would avoid them if they knew that in McFadden the post-conviction counsel wasn't going to file it, if it was going to be filed with the wrong court. And these are not academic questions. I've had that, too, where we actually had two clients
filing
by the
with
same
the wrong
name.
Court isn't really a problem anymore.
Well, in my case, the court didn't transfer it, but we were able to get it taken care of in time. Filing in the post office, those things are not known at the time the Form 40
you can't.
In the bug case, I think the person pro se filed in the wrong court, but we said it was okay because it was filed in the courts generally. So we give bug case.
But you're saying you can't allege timeliness in your petition when you write it, or in your motion when you write it, because you write it before all the problems arose. So
that's correct.
You can't say, and I tried to file it timely because
right.
Not until later that it wasn't.
Right.
But what about the amended motion? Is that something we should require to be asserted at that point?
It certainly isn't at this time, and I have a difficulty with some of the ideas that the post-conviction counsel is going to be required to do something when the rules require the state to do something that they're not, but that would be one answer. I also, there were some questions that the courts had. This is, and respondents talked about motion-based pleading, and this has been discussed before. This isn't, as the court has said, a straight criminal case, a straight civil case. There's a history here. There's a conviction. There's either a guilty plea or a conviction, a trial. So, and often the motion court is hopefully the same judge who heard it. So the court does have more initiative in the case. The court appoints counsel. The court reviews and makes decisions as to whether the allegations
are conclusively. These are treated as civil cases, not.
I'm sorry?
These are treated as, the 2915s are civil cases.
They are, but the court does take more action to enforce the rules in this case.
Are there any more questions?
I would submit that Snyder is enforcing the court rules as they are written. It is a waiver. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I think it's important to note that the reason we're here is to determine whether or not the trial court, the motion court in these cases, erred when it did not dismiss these motions as untimely. And I think both Judge Stith and Judge Fisher recognized, regardless of what action the prosecutor took or failed to take, in this particular case, the prosecutor did take some action, as did the defendant's attorney. Did the court still have the responsibility, and was the court in fact obligated to dismiss these untimely motions because they were untimely? And as Judge Fisher indicated, the language is pretty strong in this case. It's 2435, but also in 2915B, shall constitute a complete waiver.
How do you distinguish it, for example, from the case of Moore Automotive versus Goffstein, where the term shall was used to say, if you don't answer the garnishment interrogatories, they shall be deemed admitted?
I believe Judge
Fisher decided quite rightly that the shall doesn't mean shall.
I think Judge Fisher indicated that the distinction when and I can't recall the term he used today, was here there's a consequence, and the specific consequence is it shall constitute a complete waiver of any right to proceed.
And so why, since it does use the word waiver and not bar or other words, why don't all the rules about waiver apply, including that if that you can waive waiver, that you have to raise the issue of waiver or at the trial level, or you can't raise it at a later point?
I think it's inextricably tied to, first of all, the discussions we've had about there's no responsive pleading required here. And we would submit in our case, even though there were actually a motion to dismiss filed by, the defense attorney filed a motion to rescind the waiver alleging untimeliness, which was overruled. Then the prosecutor did file a motion to dismiss as untimely.
But there are countless numbers of Supreme Court rules. I had a case once where the trial judge was out of time for an answer, and he expanded the time, even though the rules say you shall answer, you shall do this and that. He expanded the time after the time had gone by retroactively, and he gave the other side more time. I mean, there's countless number, especially Supreme Court rules, where the judges have a lot of latitude in expanding the time, even though there's extraordinary amount of shalls. Shalls is a common word in rules.
Well, as this court has done in McFadden and the other cases, I believe Fisher, that I don't know if it's fair to characterize that as an expansion, but there are obviously this court has found there are exceptions or excuses for an untimely filing. So I think that Judge
and you couldn't raise those in the pleading, because as opposing counsel points out, you don't know about them at the time you're filing your Form 40 and asking for relief. You have no idea that the clerk is going to refuse to file it, or that the post office is going to lose it, or whatever else may happen. So you can't require that those issues be explained and countered and shown to be timely in the petition itself or for relief.
Well, that's correct. And I believe in an earlier argument, though I think the term was used, that unless you have a very proactive circuit court that is very quick on dismissing a pro se motion, there is the opportunity of the amended motion to address that. And it's interesting that the rules under both 24035 and 2915, to the extent they even refer to a responsive pleading by the state, refer to it as taking place after the amended motion.
What about what opposing counsel says under Rule 5527? It says, if a pleading sets forth a claim for relief to which the adverse party is not required to serve a responsive pleading, the adverse party may assert at the trial any defense in law or fact to the claim for relief. In other words, it says you have to do so at the trial, not on appeal. You can't raise it for the first time on appeal. And here, in fact, it was asserted at trial and then withdrawn. And opposing counsel said, I have lots of evidence showing it's timely, but you're withdrawing your motions. I want to let you know that I have these witnesses, but I'm not going to have them available since you withdrew your motion.
Well, the facts...
Then it's like, go ahead.
Well, Judge, the facts in this case are, or I should say the record in this case is not an ideal record. There was an evidentiary hearing. And prior to the evidentiary hearing, as I indicated, the state had filed a motion to dismiss, which was later withdrawn. The record does not indicate why that was withdrawn. And we would submit that withdrawing the motion to dismiss for a lack of timeliness, for failure to file a timely pro se motion, should not be equated with an agreement or But nevertheless...
But doesn't it sort of sandbag the judge and the when you withdraw it, then you raise it at a later point?
Well, at the evidentiary hearing, I think the record reflects that the court, after the evidence was taken, the court indicated, the court asked the question, I believe, is this timely or is it not? And there was some discussion about it. And yes, the movement, I believe I'm characterizing it correctly, believe that they were perhaps being sandbagged because they said there were witnesses available.
So what was the answer when the judge asked, is it timely or not?
Well, and it's unclear, and because the court...
The judge found it to be timely, I guess.
Well, what the judge said during the evidentiary hearing was that there was some discussion of Webb and JCW and Webb and how this is not purportedly jurisdictional anymore, but whether there was authority. And the court indicated, I believe, that it's clear that the judge didn't sounded like it hadn't been settled, that he may be out of it, it may be there may be jurisdiction to hear this, but it may be an untimely filing nevertheless. Notably, the findings of fact and conclusions of law did not address the issue of timeliness. We did raise it on appeal.
And is that fair, without giving opposing counsel a chance to put on that evidence you knew she had? I mean, to say you can raise it, withdraw it, and then raise it on appeal?
As far as this case is concerned, Judge, I think there was no unfairness for the following reasons. At the evidentiary hearing, the movement's attorney indicated there were these witnesses. Since people are talking anecdotally about their experiences, many evidentiary hearings are continued for further evidence to either have a deposition
in a situation like this where the Court of Appeals is deciding on a basis that timeliness that the trial court didn't decide, where it's raised on appeal and decided on appeal, shouldn't they remand to allow an opportunity for the opposing counsel to put on evidence? Or why is it appropriate to raise and resolve this issue for the first time on appeal without giving an opportunity to put on evidence?
And Judge, this, I would answer that in two ways. And one is first of all, it's important and that the overarching concern here is that the court enforce its own rules, regardless of what these attorneys
do.
Its
rules are that it's waived if it's not timely, but how do we know if it's timely or not?
And in this case, an evidentiary hearing was held. The movement had the opportunity to bring those witnesses to the evidentiary hearing and present evidence. Now, the record is perhaps not satisfactory as to why was the motion withdrawn, why were these witnesses not there. At that point, what could have been done was the evidentiary hearing could have been continued so these witnesses could be called if it turns out that was an issue. Perhaps it was an understanding. We don't know, and I apologize for speculating, but that's unfortunately the record we have. Don't believe a remand for further evidentiary hearing is necessary because that was the opportunity the movement had.
So if the burden is, I'm not sure I agree with it, if the burden's on the defendant to bring forward a testimony as far as it being timely, they have 10 witnesses there, and you say, well, I have a motion, now I'm going to withdraw it, and they don't have the hearing, I mean, they were ready to do it. They were ready to prove it.
I don't believe
that. They were able to go forward, and then the judge asked, is it timely or not? And it seems almost inconceivable, but maybe it is conceivable. The judge would file findings of fact, conclusions of law, if they thought the case was untimely. I mean, why would you go through the effort of findings of fact, conclusions of law if it's untimely?
Well, and of course, our position is that the court erred in not dismissing it as untimely. But I think, Judge Seidelman, the scenario that you outlined there is not exactly what occurred here. I think there's uncertainty. It was, in some ways, maybe a freewheeling discussion on the record, nevertheless, I'm not clear, for example, that those witnesses were actually present that day. But what I submit is that was an opportunity.
Well, they said they had witnesses one day, the state withdrew its motion, so then they came the next time and, of course, didn't have witnesses since the state had withdrawn it. So then suddenly raising the issue a second time. I mean, sandbagging is not, our rule can't be set up so that you can sandbag or mislead the other side into thinking something's not an issue.
I would point out, though, Your Honor, that the court was apparently the one that raised the issue again of timeliness, and I'm sure the attorneys were both cognizant of the fact that they could not, they possibly could not waive whether or not it was timely.
So let me make sure I'm clear. At the appellate court, who raised the issue of timeliness, the state or the court?
The state raised the okay. In the Southern District in our brief.
All right, unlike our first two cases.
Yes, I raised it.
Your opponent argues in her responsive brief that the doctrine of judicial estoppel should apply, that you can't take one position at one court, and then the next court take a different position. Can you respond to that judicial estoppel doctrine?
Thanks, Judge Russell. I think it doesn't apply for any number of reasons, but one specific reason is, again, going back to the record, here we have a motion to dismiss for lack of a timely filing that was subsequently withdrawn by the prosecutor. But we would submit that that withdrawal of the motion is not clearly inconsistent, that their position later, if in fact they were asserting an untimely filing of the pro se motion, was not inconsistent with their motion, their withdrawal of the motion to dismiss.
Why?
And here's a possibility. Because, again, the record reflects that perhaps they believe that the movement would be putting on evidence at the evidentiary hearing that would show whether or not this motion that was apparently on its face untimely, and in this case it was over 2 years, should nevertheless be considered excusable because of the circumstances. And in fact, if the legal file includes a response by the movement to his attorney's earlier motion to rescind the appointment for an untimely filing, saying that his girlfriend attempted to file it with the circuit clerk, and apparently he alleged that it had been lost. What I'm saying then is that there was an opportunity to put on that evidence. That the fact that the state had earlier withdrawn its motion to dismiss could be interpreted in a number of different ways. One of which was alluded to at the evidentiary hearing is that they believed, okay, let's not dispose of it in this situation. Let's wait till the evidentiary hearing and see if we're going to have an evidentiary hearing anyway. Let's see if evidence is presented regarding whether or not this untimely filing should be.
I want to question your characterization of the issue as trial court error, because the real issue is if you characterize it as trial court error, then all of these issues come into play as to, you know, because trial court error can be waived. But isn't the issue, and it was discussed earlier in the argument, whether the court has an independent ability to enforce its own rules? And so whether the trial court should have enforced its rules or not, doesn't the appellate court have the right to enforce the requirement that these pleadings be timely filed?
Absolutely, Judge Breckenridge. And we believe that that transcends any agreement that was
And isn't the same type of inherent right for a notice of appeal? Because there could be factual issues as to whether the notice of appeal was timely filed. And isn't it the same? The court still has a right to dismiss an appeal if it is not timely filed.
Absolutely.
Do we do that automatically, though, or don't we issue orders to show cause so that the factual issues can be brought out?
I couldn't presume what the normal practice is. I don't know if that's always the case. I honestly don't know if the court always issues an order to show cause. I think Judge Russell referred to a request for transfer, for example, extremely strict guideline or deadline of 15 days. If my opposing counsel had been aggrieved at the ruling from the Southern District and filed a motion for rehearing and transfer that was subsequently denied, and we had agreed that file your request for transfer in a month or so, that wouldn't hold much weight with the court, certainly, notwithstanding our agreement. And if she was unfortunate enough to have agreed
with the state can't bind what the appellate courts may or may not do based on its conduct in the motion court.
Certainly not under the rules, and especially where the court has an obligation to enforce those rules, in this case. And we would submit that the untimely filing of, in this particular case, the by 2 years of the pro se motion acted as such a waiver. We would request that this court do a remand with instructions to the circuit court to dismiss as untimely.
Any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, in cases of waiver, objections, and other matters, we don't ask why the waiver was, why the person waived it, why the state waived it in this case. It was waived. That's all that matters. Had the state wanted to pursue it at the evidentiary hearing and wanted a continuance, the motion court should have said, I see right here you've waived it. That's done.
Can you address the issue of whether this court or the Court of Appeals has an independent right to enforce the rules and dismiss because it's untimely, and that it's not that the state can't circumvent the rules and this court's right to dismiss?
That was raised in Swofford, and again, in a way that's, I'm not saying it's begging the question, but it raises this question, what rules are we enforcing? Because Snyder, in the Western District, has purported to enforce the rules. It's enforcing the waiver portion of 24035. It's enforcing 5508, 5509, and 5527. So the question again becomes, what rules are we going to enforce?
Well, let's say in enforcing the rules, let's say the state in its duty as the Attorney General of the state of Missouri or the prosecutor representing the people of Missouri, were to say after the trial, oops, there was a mistake, or there was incompetent counsel, and they filed the notice 10 days late, but there was still incompetent counsel. Why wouldn't they? Couldn't they just say, well, we'll just hear it and present, and the state could say what there was bad counsel, and it should be a new trial. But they can't do it outside of 2915. I mean, why wouldn't the deadline say, nope, sorry, state can't raise that issue, or the state can't even concede the timeline so they can get some justice in the case after all the rest is going forward?
Why can't they? I'm not quite understanding.
I'm saying, why can't they waive? There's an assertion saying, well, they can't waive the timeline. It is something that's authority. If they felt that the an injustice was done, maybe it's a Brady violation or something else, or the counsel for the defendant was incompetent, why shouldn't they be able to say, let's have the hearing, and they might lose, but yet justice might be done?
My take would be that would never reach this court is probably what would happen. It would just never come up and be something. My fear is that someday there's going to be some, and this is why I very much appreciate this court's engagement in all three cases, some relief granted and then on appeal taken away. Or these are issues, as I've said, not academic. They're very troubling to the public defender's office and a great concern of how this procedure should be. Couple things. The gun case, I know that I'm not speaking Mr. Bartholomew here, but that I think Chamberlain versus the Department of Revenue is a recent Southern District. In the wake of the Webb case, these cases are being considered entirely differently. Subject matter jurisdiction is not a concern anymore because we're here, we're the court that this comes before, we have jurisdiction. It may be a different question, but whatever it is, it's not jurisdiction.
Let me ask a question along that lines. I've asked it to some of the other counsel. My concern is concerning the ruling of these cases. If your argument was accepted that these claims are waivable, because they're not raised, other than untimeliness, what other things do you think constitute affirmative defenses that the state would have to raise in post-conviction cases, even though there's no pleading requirement?
I had that written down, Your Honor. That was my other point. Waiver is the issue here in this case, and that's why we're saying it's a particularly defense, as Judge Stitha says, a waiver may be waived, because it's specifically stated as a waiver, which I am arguing is an affirmative defense. So I would think nothing else. I remind the court that 5509 states specifically that all answers are deemed allegations.
All allegations are deemed denied.
Thank you.
If you're thinking about this, you're thinking that untimeliness is probably the only thing that the state can waive?
sure don't want to be bound by that someday. I would say that's...
Sometimes we don't want to be bound by our own decisions either, but you know, there's this thing called the rule of law that's very pesky at times. That's why we try to get the full benefit of your knowledge on these issues.
That's not much. I cannot think of anything. I mean, I'm trying to run through the list in 5508. I know that Your Honor stated...
What about failure to state a cause of action for
failure
which relief
to state
can be
a cause
granted?
Of action. Yeah. You know, that
is that
goes,
the type of affirmative defense that now the state's going to have to raise either in a pleading or orally at trial?
That kind of goes back to what has been argued, that this is a motion-based procedure where the trial court or the motion court takes a little bit more of a proactive role than it has than it does in a regular case. I believe the motion court kind of looks and sees whether there is a conclusive showing.
Are there any cases that use the term proactive versus active?
I'm sorry?
Are there any cases, are we talking about case law that says proactive versus active? Do we have to use proactive?
I think you're right. An active view. In fact, it's probably more active than proactive in this case. But they look over these cases to see if they conclusively are entitled to no relief. And Vesca for this to be reversed back to determine the merits in the Southern District or to give Mr. Hill an opportunity to prove his timeliness of assertions.
Thank you very much. Any more questions? Thank you very much.